día se llevaron a los comunistas y yo no dije nada.
Hi everybody, here we are again, another Friday, and we are very happy because we have had a kind of adventure. Carrie was coming or tried to pick up the car,
the train,
and it was a kind of accident. This is what I learned before. So she was very clever and she called Mike. So now we are here, four of us, having a wonderful Friday night without any drink or any food, but still we are having fun and we have a another wonderful guest, Betsy. She will introduce herself. She's a wonderful poet, very well published, but she is dreaming to have her own book. So maybe some of the people in the audience will bring to her that dream come true. Hi, my dear Betsy. Okay, go ahead. Introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Betsy Fogelman-Tai. I have been in Portland since 2008. I was the teacher librarian at Roosevelt for 12 years until my retirement in 2022. I have two grown children, both in the city, which is a great pleasure, and a wild yard. I call myself the haphazard gardener. What I plan, if it lives, good. If it doesn't, c'est la vie. Or how would we say that in Spanish, Consuelo?
Es la vida.
Es la vida. I have published widely. I've been writing poetry since I was a teenager. I've studied with many very notable poets. I've been a semi-finalist twice with my manuscript for a book prize. But as Consuelo said, I'm still waiting to win. But this year, I do have a pushcart, a poem in the pushcart anthology, coming soon, available to you in December. And I understand our topic is autobiography, which is of great interest to me, because what I know is that poems must be emotionally true. Hopefully, they are true to their image. They don't necessarily have to be true to the facts of a person's life. And I certainly, early in my writing life, almost everything I wrote was very autobiographical. I had a very influential and important American poet. James Wright was my mentor when I was at the end of my college years. And at some point he said to me, "You have to move away from autobiography." And it's been a constant question for me. My more recent poems and the poems I've written in the last 10, 15 years, they are much less true to the facts of my life. And I actually have felt liberated to be more imaginative and more fantastical, and to engage in the poetry of witness in a certain way. It has made me more interested in others and less in my own story. But I have many, many, many poems that are grounded in my life story. I sent Consuelo three, but she never got them.
Yeah, that was magical magical too, because I will have the joy to listen in your own voice for the first time. And I am so happy. In the meantime,
yes,
I want to remember our beautiful audience that our phone number is 503-231-8187. I am still nervous about what happened today. Anyway, I think our line are open for you to call us, to congratulate our guest, to ask her question, to talk about yourself. You know that we have a very casual program every other Friday, and we want your participation. this presentation, this introduction that she has made is wonderful because she is already, Betsy is telling a lot about herself. We know that she started very early writing and she went to college. She has a mentor, what is very important, and also two children and a free garden. So the garden can live, survive, or can say bye-bye, my dear. See you next season. Okay, I would like to ask you, who were the writer that introduced you to poetry, or who you wanted to imitate and that had a big impact in your creating writing profession?
That's a wonderful question. Thank you. So the first three poets that I read, other than, I suppose, what I might have had to read in school, were Richard Brautigan, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and Leonard Cohen, who I was pretty sure I was, you know, supposed to marry him. he didn't know. But yeah,
you did. That is what is important.
I did. Yeah. I followed him all. No, that's not true. I was quite young. I was 13 when I read those three poets, and I started writing poetry. I had the same English teacher in 7th grade and 9th grade, and I would give her my poems, and she would give them back to me, and they would have, you know, one or two words. Very good. This is good. This is good. That's all she had to do. That was all the encouragement I needed. And I think I got serious by the time I went to college. I started taking writing work. I was an English major, so I was studying literature. And then I started taking writing classes, and I stumbled into, again, you know, a kind of major poet or two that, like, what did I know? But that really changed the course of my life. So the first one, I went to Temple University in Philadelphia, which is where I was from, and I took a class at the Y there. The 92nd Street Y in New York is, you know, probably the most important poetry institution in the country, I would still claim. But the little Y in Philadelphia did well, too. So I took a class with a poet named C.K. Williams, and who I think got a, you know, he's some of our listeners may know him. And Charlie, two things happened. Charlie introduced me to the work of James Wright, who I then went to New York to hear read. And it's a long story we may not have time for, but I sort of introduced myself to him. I went back to Philadelphia on the last train that night. I wrote him a letter, and he answered me, which was really significant. Mm. So we had a correspondence for a couple of years. I met him multiple times, and he died very prematurely. He was 56, 55 or 56, which, of course, I thought was old at the time, at my 22-year-old mark. Anyway, Charlie was my teacher for a year and influenced me greatly. And he had a 3-year-old son. And at the end of the year, I said to him, Charlie, if I babysat for Jed, would you keep reading my poems? And he said, are you kidding? Like, what did I know then about how hard it was to find a good babysitter? He said, of course, I'll pay you and I'll read your poems. So I got to have a year of kind of tutoring from him, a year, maybe a little bit more, before he moved to New York. I graduated from college and I moved to New York. And in New York, I got to study again with lots of major figures at the time, including a couple of years with Galway Connell, whose son Fergus lives here. And I got to meet him. I was at a literary arts event and I met this beautiful young man named Fergus. And he said, I'm Fergus. I said, are you Fergus Connell? Which I think was, you know, kind of fun for him, since probably people don't generally know who he is or who his father was. Anyway, so I got what happened to me in New York. I got intimidated. I thought, I'm not a major talent. I still think this, you know, I'm not a major voice. I'm not important. I'm never going to be important. And I dropped out a little bit. I never stopped writing, but I thought I can't compete. I can't throw my weight against the world. And around that time is when MFAs really were coming into bloom. Actually, Galway Kinnell was, after the first year of working with him at the Y, he then moved to NYU, where I think he and Sharon Knowles were starting the MFA program there. And it was there were a couple that were long established, but other than that, this was the 80s. It was the era when MFAs were just spreading like wildfire. So I never have gotten an MFA. I've continued to study. I still take classes. I just enrolled yesterday for a two-part class with Robert Pinsky on the music of poetry. And I like this about myself, that I'm still teachable. I've been at this for more than 50 years, and I'm proud that I'm still teachable. I'm stubborn. You know, I think I know more than many people, which, you know, could be true. but I like that I'm educable and that I'm still seeking, and I still wish to learn. And, you know, I'm pretty dedicated to poetry. My life as a poet, you know, I do so many other things, but I have a daily writing practice. I revise at least a few times a week. I work on poetry. I send poetry out. Take a lot of classes, have
poet
friends.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
And I think it also is a woman attitude that in one sentence you say, I am not the one to compete. And in the other sentence you say, I am very good. I am extraordinary. I know a lot. And we all women, I think, we have this dichotomy between how we feel in some areas and another. I think, without even reading your poem, that you are a very talented woman and who has a very nice legacy, as we were talking before, and you will keep going. And the fact that you are still studying and feeling that you need to know more, that tell me right away how ambitious you are and how perfectionist you are. So it's something that is so deep on you that it will take you longer. So don't worry about the book. It will come by itself someday. And enjoy every process of the writing, because it's so hard and so lonely, goddammit. It is. Yes, and I think the fact that your poetry is autobiographical, I think it's great, because everything we do has to do with our feeling, our emotion, our sorrow. Everything is how hard is to make a cut and said, no, I am somebody else. Even if you use science fiction in your poetry, like our common friend, that create a different character, he's still talking about himself. So
sure,
let's
sure.
talk and sure. let's go to the poetry.
Okay. Okay.
Which one will be the first?
Let me get my phone back on. I'll start with a poem that's quite old now.
Yeah.
It was published in the Louisville Review, in the 90s, I think. And this was maybe one of the last poems that I wrote that just came like this. You know, I mean, I did have to revise a little bit, but it just leapt out of me. And you'll see how pressing the subject was.
Okay.
It's called
Go ahead.
Carrying My Father on My Back. A surreal metaphor enlivened, I'm walking in a national monument, debris of a people decimated by the Gentiles and their mission, and I'm searching for the spot that tells me where to spread the ashes of my father, which I carry on my back. Smaller than the coffin of an infant, the box of my father's ashes fits neatly in the flowered knapsack I bought to carry necessities. The way that I cradle him now is the way I've always wanted to handle my poor, lost father, misanthrope, alienated gambler. Now I've got his life, or what is left of what little there ever was of it, on my back, in my hands. It is the Sabbath before Passover, and I want to liberate him. He's been dead 7 weeks now, and his ashes in my closet 5. I've tried to say the mourner's Kaddish facing east each morning and to consider where his spirit might be going. I hope if he returns, it will be a something happier, brighter. The edges of the box are digging in the niche of my back. I slip my hands under to put some space between me and my father. I whisper, "Daddy, no one is gone. They're all here now, everyone. I see them in the hills, feel them in the grasses." I think of his love, how it was intermittent, hidden, and that the only time I saw him tender was as a small child when in the dark apartment he moved into with his mother, the divorce papers were delivered, and he cried, standing by the door ajar, the letter trembling in his hands. I've been remembering much these weeks. What I want to forget is the image received from his license, how he'd come to look in the years since I'd seen him, gaunt, haunted, aged. We hit the high point of the path towards south where we faced the deep green covered mountains stretched like cathedrals with that terror of sublime. So I turned back towards the ceremonial kiva that sits over the fertile valley, welcoming, warm to rest in. I imagine this is where their pockmarked dead were laid under cover of the dances. I kneel, I do the sentimental thing, chant, say prayers, read poetry. I put my hands in the ashes that were my father. I want to examine what happened to the millions in Poland and Germany. I scatter him on the hillside, saying how I've loved him. We are alone together, as we always have been. At the end, I see a white-haired man's been watching. I hope he's the angel and bless him. I walk back to the car, the knapsack much lighter. I cannot carry my father any farther.
Oh, what can I say? I mean, we are all Carrie's touching her heart, and I am making an effort not to cry because I think it's a beautiful, beautiful poem, not only because it's your experience, and every step of the poem, of your life, describing all the relationship with him, is no doubt autobiographic. So it's beautiful.
Thank you, Consuelo.
Yeah, I mean it. I mean it's perfect. There are nothing to add, nothing to take away. Well, I am not an expert, but okay, now we need another little bit more.
Oh, my God. let's see. We've got a funeral. We've got abortion.
No, you can keep going. It's your work.
Okay. Here, first of all, I just have to say I was visiting with a dear friend a couple of weeks ago, and I read her that poem. I don't know why it came up, but, you know, it had been years since I'd read it to anybody.
Yes.
And she was very moved, and she said, "Betsy, you have to resurrect that. You should send it out again." But, of course, it's been published already. Thank you.
I have been publishing the same thing that I wrote in 3 places different.
What?
Chile, here, and in Canada.
In how many languages?
In the 3 languages.
Wow.
Yeah. No, 2 languages. No, I didn't write it in French. I wrote it in English. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Only if the dog comes and sits on my lap. Now, first of all, I have to say, you are the most encouraging person. A big heart you have.
Yeah,
okay.
Read.
This is a little love fest. Come on.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
here's was that you? Vocabulary quiz for my 8th grade class.
Oh.
What a curious combination of Greek roots I have chosen for this week's quiz. Foley and mall, braiding themselves into a portrait like the ones the Victorian lightkeepers' wives made from hair. Malodorous, what wafted off you after days of chemo? How I refused to tell you the truth, though you asked over and over, you obsessively hygienic, caring for your visits, your own cleansers and defoliants. We could call this troubling, or what it was, malignance, killing you at 55. Now, on my desk, the letter from the sperm bank, dunning $400 to save your no doubt damaged sperm another year, a little longer, the folio of your life closing, poured down the drain, or wherever they dispose of the life not yet combined. What malicious, what maligned, what more to see or say? Your hair defoliated from your pear-shaped head, in your baldness a beauty we did not know you had. Maladaptive, the body to the preservatives, the fumes from dry cleaning, every item you possessed, every wearing. Malcontent, the cat who cruises your empty bed, sniffing for the spot to sink her claws and milk the mattress, trying to raise the love she cannot forget.
I think that your experience putting into word is your asset. So you should keep doing that. And I mentioned before Lucia Berlin. I don't know if you know her work. And she did exactly the same in prose, not in mm-hmm. poem. And it's very, I will say, it helped a lot to see how other people express their emotion and their feeling and how they go through that. And they're able to survive mm-hmm. in spite of. And this is what this program is that we tell people that if you put into word your experience, your sorrow, your happiness, that will help you to grow, to feel a lot of gratitude for your life, and to leave a legacy. This is it, your legacy. And your life, how wonderful, how talented can you be that you put in that these two wonderful poems a very, very a strong emotion, very painful moment of your life as a person who had cancer myself and mm. a malignant. Mm. And I know, so I think it's a prayer. That is a prayer. Yeah, keep going. Another.
How about one that's not so autobiographical?
Okay, very
but,
good.
And, but a little cheerful.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
Next time I will bring champagne.
This actually, so do you lead tours to Cuba? Did I see that?
No.
Oh, no. It doesn't say something about Cuba?
No.
Okay, all right. So this is about a true thing about the cigar factories in St. Petersburg hiring readers, which was a custom from Cuba.
Okay.
In Cuba, the workers would have readers read to them all day.
Oh.
And of course, you know, I like to think, well, the cigar factory owners in St. Petersburg were often Jews. And it's like, you know, how much we support education. The book, people of the book, right?
Okay.
Okay. The St. Petersburg, Florida cigar factory employs a reader. In the hot belly of the factory, bent over my box of tobacco leaves, stacked and supple, fattening beneath my strong fingers, plump as the palms that swayed by the sea where we would swim on Sunday, El Lector, gifted with a drum-rung voice, rang in the news, perched on the tall stool in his white suit and Panama hat, filling us with tales, bearing us the new world as we worked to make it rich. Presentando, song of myself and the Belle Dame sans merci, Shakespeare sonnets, the English a weapon with which I would win a wife, a woman proud to have a man who could roll off a word or more to secure her surrender, roses and candy, inferior tricks for wooing, less potent than the word's elixir, which seeded the garden where I would live with her. The Scarlet Letter and Walden. El Lector shook all our hands before he started, and when the sun was no longer high in the windows, as we packed away the layers of leaves and pushed our chairs under, we thanked him, singing a song or two that had carried us across the roiling waters, lullabies for him to present to his daughters.
Yeah, it's a different tone.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Also, how did this story came to you?
So I lived in the suburbs of Pensacola for 5 years,
yeah.
which is where that actually the eighth grade class was in Pensacola.
Yeah.
And I got a Florida Humanities Council grant in the summer to go to an NEH, well, like a Florida Humanities Council week-long workshop, but a seminar. And it was in, was it in St. Pete or it was in the next town over? I can't remember. But they took us, we got to go to one of the cigar factories. And it was just mentioned that they'd had a reader. So then this is, you know, where the imagination starts to come into play.
I remember the book, The Reader.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The same.
Yeah.
I think it's, I have, this is a parenthesis. I have been very impressed by The Reader, the movie and the book. I read it. And also a wonderful movie called The Ceremony, the La Ceremonie, the Chabrol, French director. And both emphasize the people who don't know how to read. I think there are two awful things in life, not to know the ocean and not to know how to read.
The Reader was the Bernard Schlink book, right?
Yeah.
And is it about an adult who's illiterate? I can't remember.
Yes, she is a German, and she finds this young man who is reading to her. And another question to you, I think, is now in what kind of a wave are you? Are you, no, the question that I had before was, how did you make the transition between speaking and writing about yourself and now speaking about others? That, I think, was interesting. It was because you got more mature. It was because you were an observer more than an actress in the world, and you wanted to pay attention to others and their suffering and their experience, and that became into your heart and to your mind.
I'm not sure I know the answer. I think probably in some way I wanted some relief from my story. Those years in Florida were excessively hard. I had a series of events that were devastating. So, and that's a long time ago because I've, you know, I moved there in 2003. So starting 20 years ago, I had these five terrible years. So maybe I just wanted to stop thinking about myself. I wanted to stop.
You escaped. So it was an exit door.
Yes.
The exit door.
I'm like, I can't, I won't live if I keep just, you know,
thinking about that
suffering.
Pain.
Yeah,
it's so good to leave the past in the past, but also.
So that, and I reached a point where I was having trouble starting poems. And I started taking more classes where prompts were offered. And if I listen to a prompt, if I get a prompt orally, not visually, if I get it orally, sometimes it's just like the golden key. It just opens my mind to, like, I don't know where it comes from. You know, it's divine. There's a divine moment where, and it's much more imaginative. So that's probably been in the past 15 years that I've done more of that kind of writing in response to prompts, in part. And I think from the time that James Wright said that to me, 45 years ago, I felt it was incumbent on me in some, I mean, of course we're never going to leave our stories out.
No.
They inform everything we write, but, you know, often the truest poems are the ones that are most specific about your life and they do liberate other people.
Have you tried to write fiction? I mean, a short story, short story.
Yes,
prose.
A little bit. So I've written some nonfiction. I did publish an essay some years ago now, with the Georgia Review. That was good, about James Wright. Made the most money I've made as a writer.
Yes,
I'm well over $2,000 or $3,000 now. after 50 years, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I'm rolling.
Good for
rolling.
You.
Rolling.
Good for you.
Anyway.
So how was the experience of trying a different...
I very much like essays, and I thought when I retired I would do more, but I just seem to be, like, busy living and enjoying my life, and I do have a writing practice, but I'm not, like, breaking my arse to just write all the time. Anyway,
I mean,
it could be in my future.
You have to live also, and you have to write.
Yeah, I'm just having, like, such a good time. The other thing I did try, if you want to hear for the story, is when I lived in Santa Fe for 14 years. That's where my kids were born. When my father died, I came into a little bit of money, and I bought my first computer, and I took 6 months off from my job to just work half time. Because I was going to write a screenplay. Because I'm like, you know, poetry, it's visual. It's all image, you know. If I can do that, I can write a screenplay and, you know, I'll make money. And after, I think, 3 months, I went back to work.
And the Oscar goes, the Oscar goes to Betsy.
I was so bad at it. It was like, I was really bad. So I started 2 or 3 screenplays. I have started, I don't know if I've ever finished a story, but I've got a folder of stories. I mean, I read poetry constantly, but I read a lot of fiction, literary fiction. So sure, you know, I wanted to, but.
It's nice, I think, to open, this is part of your being, ambitious, or like I said before, ambition and very perfectionist. This is is your drive, and to try one thing or another, and to prove to yourself how good you are.
Yeah.
And it has been working.
You know what I'm really good at? I'm really a good cook. That I'll say. I'm really a good cook. So, I'm an okay poet, but I'm a really good cook.
You are not an okay poet. Stop it. Oh, I will open the door. And if you are a good cook, you should write about that.
Yeah. Oh, I did some food writing.
Ah,
I did. A little bit, just a little bit in Santa Fe. I published a little bit with a couple of newspapers.
Yeah. How I visualize your book is a little bit of the poem here, the essay here, and the one who don't go in any category.
Yeah. Ah?
So this way you have, because you are a very diversified writer.
Yeah.
And that is very good. Okay. Something else.
Okay, let's see. What should be next?
Whatever you want.
Okay. Here's one that...
I like the idea of you writing an essay. I love essay. It's indeed my favorite.
Yeah.
One of my favorite.
Yeah.
And I think for all the... How you use the language, I think the essay should be very, very, very pretty.
Yeah. I'll just tell you.
Yes.
When I retired, I don't remember when I came up with the idea, but I thought I really wanted to travel. So I have taken two major trips. That's a big part of my ambition now, is one major trip every year.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, how can I see the world for free? And I thought, I'm going to try to get hired on cruise ships. Because they have experts that give talks. And what am I an expert on? Modern poetry. And so I was going to write 5 talks about these famous poets I've known.
Yeah.
Poets I've known. And I started, I don't know, I wrote like 6 paragraphs, maybe 10. On a couple of them, you know, 2 or 3 of them I started. And then I'm like, I don't want to work this hard. No, I'd rather spend the money on the trips. I don't want to work this hard. Anyway.
So it didn't work? I already have to you for you American Cruises. You can offer, because I applied to
a
position I didn't. Yeah. And because I was in Chile when she was interviewing me. And 1 week, 10 days, perfect for you.
To do what? What were you going to do?
Yeah, a presentation to tell the story of the place where we were going through and take them to the land and make a tour. A guide or a speech. Mm-hmm. There you have. Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so this might have been one of the first poems that I wrote. I mean, there's quite a few rather old poems with me. And then maybe I'll read a couple new ones. But this is in the voice of someone else. So this is when I was teaching in New York.
Yes.
So, you know, many, many, many years ago. And I'm the teacher. The Chinese girl speaks. When the classroom is noisy, I feel like a shell underwater, sucked back and forth by the tide, chipping a bit, a bit on something rougher. I leave the house in dark, my father breathing softly in his half-sleep. I can hardly remember the color of the carpet in the light or how my mother looks laughing, her left hand covering her teeth. I wonder why, always the left. In the evening, I walk to the garment factory, and bent over my machine, I think of the movies I've watched and the songs in them. I sing them low to myself in my clipped accent. I want to go to a college where steam will billow from my mouth as I talk to two handsome seniors lounging against huge elms, bragging about the programs they've written on their IBM computers. I want to look like the teacher with her sweater pushed up at the sleeves and the collar open. She's tall and kind. Sometimes she talks so fast I'm only half sure of what she is saying, but I nod yes and won't volunteer the answer to a difficult question. When the black boy sitting next to me looks over, I swell like the throat of a frog before it chatters. Tonight, I will go home, brew tea, and wash out my jersey. Tomorrow, when one of them speaks to me, I will not look down, but straight back, an American.
I like it too. Yeah, it's different, but I like it. So how that was born?
It's so old, I don't even know. Looking at the girls, thinking about their habits, thinking about all these kids. I was teaching at Seward Park on the Lower East Side, and it had been a traditionally Jewish neighborhood, and now it was mostly Chinese immigrants. And the kids, as far as I knew, many of them did work in the factories at night. You know, they'd be in school all day. They'd go to the factories all night. They were working so hard to wanting to assimilate, and very foreign. You know, still very minimal English. Many of them maintaining the habits of the homeland. You know, and the family. Thinking in a girl's mind.
I like the perspective of from the teacher view. I like very much because you were, again, an observing of the situation. So almost like a camera, taking a picture and describing their life and how hard their life was.
Yes.
Sad too, but no problem. We can deal with that. Okay, another.
Very demanding.
Yeah, demanding. Because we have the time is passing and I want to take advantage. I think you will have to come back, huh?
Oh, sure, if you want me to.
Yes, you, of course.
All right.
You have to come back.
Okay. Okay, here's one that has nothing to do with that. Oh, no, that's not true. It has a little autobiography in it.
Don't lie to us.
This is pretty new.
Okay.
It's called Divination.
Oh.
Frederick II, Holy Roman Emperor, purportedly had a dying man sealed in an airtight wine vat to observe if the soul perished along with the body. Did witnesses expect when the barrel was shattered they'd see the soul there, curled like a snakeskin beside the bones? Or might soul rise like smoke from a diminishing fire and seep from the seams? Perhaps the vat was simply weighed before and after, or they thought they might distinguish the odor of body decaying in oak from a rotting soul. I would like to conduct a similar experiment, to lock you in your room and see if you come out fully human, stripped of your bare fur attack teeth, your nails trimmed, your once sweet smile on. Then I would buy you a new fur-rimmed coat and parade you down the street, hugging your arm, your hip, your breastbone, against which lay your curled pet snake, its glistening eye half closed, its skin about to flake.
Interesting. I need to read it myself again. I mean, it has a more complicated for me,
yeah,
some word, that a knowing word, what is nice. So how this was born?
It was born with that. I don't remember why. It was born with Frederick II.
Yes.
And this whole experiment of seeing if he could, you know, separate the soul from the body at death. And I think I was just searching for something from history to write about. I don't really remember.
Oh, that is good enough.
Yeah.
I mean, that, again, is that your diversity in, mm-hmm, in subject, in theme,
mm-hmm,
and in style.
Mm-hmm.
And where are you? How do you see your creativity? In what direction is going? What do you want to do that you haven't done? Or have you been thinking, oh, I would like, I know the book, but outside of the book, about the process of writing, what do you want? How you visualize yourself going with your talent?
That's another good question. Maybe 2 years ago, I took a class where we were to write a poem in response to a Anne Sexton poem called I Remember. And I wrote, you know, we were writing during the class, I think, and I wrote the first one. So they were 22-line poems. Each line was very short. And I wrote the first one that night, and since then I've written 100 maybe. Mm-hmm. And so as that started, I thought, you know, I'm just going to keep writing them for a while, and then I'll create a chapbook or some kind of book out of the best ones. And I haven't done it again. You know, I'm like, I'm too busy having fun. But I'll say, and I do think that this is one of the features of what I'll call the MFA generation, is they're very oriented towards projects. They start a book by saying, you know, they conceive of a project and they write the book in accordance with what the project is. And then they have a manuscript that coheres thematically or in some other way. And I've never been that poet. So, you know, this is the closest I've ever gotten, is saying all the poems in this book, if I ever finish it, are these I Remember poems.
I like that. For me, it's easier if I have that kind of discipline and organization.
Yeah.
If I said, that is the reason because I like to write, I do research, a lot of research.
Yes.
So it's about this woman, it's about the other woman, it's about this.
Yes.
And this is one way I organize myself.
Yes.
And so give me some direction where to go, and I can visualize the final product.
And I have tried over the years with some regularity to conceive of a project. I had something, oh my goodness, now I'm just forgetting the, I came up with a form, like I invented a form of, it had to do with questions and answers. I can't think of what I was calling it right now. But in some way, they lack passion for me. You know, I couldn't follow through with any of them. I'm a Gemini.
Yeah.
I need a lot of novelty.
Yes.
You know, I can't like say this is what I'm going to do. And then like I didn't write the talks about the poets to try to get hired on the ships. I'm like, I get bored with it after 5 minutes. So,
yeah, we have to be consistent with our nature, and
yeah,
we have to be true to ourselves.
Yeah.
Especially at this time in our life.
Yeah.
I mean, this is who we are, period.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what we do. I have talent. I like it, but I have to direct. You have to find your own way. So as a summary, you are doing day by day, step by step, whatever comes in the way,
yes,
you will take that adventure.
Yes.
Because to write is an adventure. Any artistic task is an adventure because you don't know where it starts, where it will end.
Yes.
Okay, one of the last poems because the time is running.
Okay, let's see what it should be. All right, here's a poem that is yet to be published that I love.
Okay.
You better say you love it.
Yes, okay. I will. I give you
got Mark laughing over there. Okay, hold on. I need water. And it has a little, you know, it's got a hint of autobiography in it.
Neat. Do you have a journal, too? Oh, you haven't had a journal during your 5 years that you said that you had a very difficult time. Did you have a journal?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So next time, will you bring the journal?
Okay, yeah, sure. what makes the horse race? What makes her dance out of the paddock, her silver fetlock shaking like the bell that announces the start, and they're off? 17 hands and carrying a small burden. What makes her reach, pull back, run alongside the others, a train parallel to the highway, chugging along until just as the curve of the headland appears, she breaks loose, that train plowing straight off the shear. She's solo, her legs an open line. She flies, Pegasus gracing these earthly games, ahead by half a league. What does she know about winning, about the wreath of braided roses, the bucket of ice in which the champagne chills, the smile stretched so broadly it almost breaks the face of her owner, like a mirror shattering to reflect the change of circumstance? A loser, now a winner, he can drop his sorry monologue about how it's ordained, some people always on top, others smothered, how fate had dropped him on the wrong side of the fence when he was born, and he'd never seen the hasp on the winner's gate so close before as it rose majestically to swing open and admit him. She's won, or he has, but what does she know of what's changed? She knows what is still the same, her frothy flanks brushed down by muscled hands of the waiting groom who nuzzles her nose and murmurs her praises, sneaks her an apple, watches as she sloshes her pint of stout, walks her slowly back to the winner's circle where the roses go around her neck and the owner cradles her head in his arms. What does she know when she turns her royal head towards the camera, the glint in her dark eye like a shooting star on the edge of clouds on a moonlit night over the endless water?
No wonder. Now I understand. Why do you like it so much? You love it.
I love it. I can't believe nobody's published it.
Yeah. Maybe you have to be patient, more patient.
Yeah.
There are nothing else.
I haven't sent it out in a long time. This one, you haven't asked this question about this one, but I will tell you, this one started because I heard a radio show about it wasn't Secretariat, it was some horse that won in the last 10 years, let's say, who would get stout after a winning race.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Like goodness. The beer.
How sad. Okay. How much more minute do we have?
Eight.
Oh, so we have 8 minutes, so we have for another poem.
Oof. Okay.
Not too long, not too short.
Okay, all right. Let's see what we should do.
Oh, we can talk about the process of writing.
Sure.
You said that you started very young.
Yes.
And you have been doing for 50 years, more or less, or less. And so you have a certain, obviously, a discipline. You have been educating yourself. You have been living in different places. Now you are traveling. Where did you go?
First trip was Ireland, Scotland, and Wales.
I love Ireland. Mm-hmm. Love Ireland. Mm-hmm. Yes. Beautiful.
What's not to love?
That's true. Yeah. Yes.
And it was a poetry trip. The whole I was gone for about a month, and the whole trip was anchored around a week-long poetry trip.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
It was very nice.
Beautiful.
And then last year I went to India for about a month.
Okay, so there's another book, The Trip.
True.
Yes, everything that you saw, and, I am here kind of your manager. telling you what to do. But no, I am not telling you what to do. It's only an idea. I think it would be nice. How many writers, they have been written about their experience in the trip and how they felt. And because the trip is before, after, before, during, and after, I always say. So the after is what maybe will come in an essay or in a poem.
Yeah, me and Ian Forrester.
Yes. Yes.
You know.
Yes. Okay. So.
Okay.
Let's
Okay. One more.
I will start saying bye bye because if she take the last minute,
okay,
we will go. We will say good night from Betsy and I and Mike and Carrie, and I want to say one more time thank you very much for your kindness and professional people who come and help in the situation. And go ahead, and I hope to be with you again December the 6th. Here we will be. So the last poem by Betsy, and this is the first chapter. We will have a second chapter. Don't worry.
Are there any listeners that wish to ask any final question?
Well, no, they still can call. And the phone number is 503-231-1887. The same mistake again. Okay, yeah, read.
Okay, again, so far from autobiography, but, you know, I think it's got something, some emotional truth. And this was the winner of the Dueling Judges Award from the Oregon Poetry Association.
Nice.
War makes cannibals of us all. The 1947 school book unveiled a story. A pilot downed on desolate Takashima, his prospects hopeless. Besides the cold and barrenness, the ruined craft, and injury, his leg, thus immobility. No lights, no fire, no food, sounds of scurrying spiders and Komodo dragons sharpening their teeth against the rock. The first day, hysteria. The fourth, resignation. On the seventh, he drew from his pocket the sharp knife, lifted his issued shirt, stroked his tender belly, which growled as his dog would if it watched. He made a thin slice, turned up the skin, sawed off a sliver of subcutaneous fat, and ate. A few days later, again, he unbound his belly, mapping it further with the road to survival, sewing his life by the thin thread of his own flesh to the mountain rock, to the dark that descended, to the stars that rose without a word, and the sun that turned by no command. Did swallowing turn his stomach? It turned his chances. Years later, he confessed that even in the comfort of his white picket fence life, fed daily by the aproned wife, he struggled with a craving perverse, dense as an old tree, to cut again, to taste, to know what he was from the inside out, then in again.
Okay, how this poem was born.
I picked up this book, and there was this story about a pilot that ate from his body.
Oh.
And so I had to imagine the circumstances.
Yeah. So it has a big impact on you, the story.
Well, you know, it captivated my imagination, and really isn't that all we want as writers? We just want our imaginations to be snagged, excited.
Yeah.
Inflamed.
Keep going. Keep going. Yeah, adventure, I would say. Yeah. Adventure. Yeah. And to be seduced.
Yeah.
I think it's beautiful when we find a wonderful word that we haven't even used and suddenly come and that word seduce us and it come perfect to the line and to the paragraph and we feel like, oh, this is what it is.
And as Pound said famously,
yes.
No surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader. You know, we also want the surprise.
Yes, yes. I think the surprise is because life surprises us in many ways. We know that. And also the text has to bring that surprise and that final cut at the end when we don't know, oh, this is what happened, and that is what it is. It doesn't need to be mysterious, but it has to be something that we didn't imagine that will be the end. So, oh, we start with the end, and suddenly at the end of the poem, it's not dead. It's alive again.
Yes.
So this way. And in terms of adjective and noun, what do you use the most? Because we in a group of writers, sometimes we talk about that. Do you like to use adjective, or do you like to use more noun? Or you don't even think about it?
I do think about it. Verb.
Verb. What? The verb. You know?
Yeah.
St. John's.
Yeah.
The verb.
Yeah.
The verb is everything.
Yeah.
Okay, here we are. Bye bye, everybody.
Bye bye.
Bye bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. Thank you to you, both of you. And